Good afternoon, America. Welcome to the Raucous Caucus. This is Mark Levine, and I am on the line with...
Terry D. Kester, Doctor of Democracy.
The self-proclaimed Doctor of Democracy. And Garland Nixon, are you there?
Garland's here.
Oh, Garland's there. There you
can
are.
Can we go back to the music, then?
You prefer the music over Garland? There is a lot in the news today. There is an article in the Washington Post front page section which shows that the resignation of the Pope wasn't just because of old age, but has to do with a complex financial scandal. And I guess we shouldn't be surprised to hear that it was more than just the Pope got old and tired, because after all, they sort of all do. So I want to get to that. And then, Terry, you want to talk about disaster preparedness, right?
Simply because we don't do disaster preparedness. We just wait till the disaster happens, and then we bitch and complain.
Okay, so we're going to get on that. And then, Garland, do you have a topic this hour?
Not really.
So Garland will just
kind of... Pay attention, Garland. We got stuff for you.
He'll mooch on our topics, so that's fine.
There we go.
Folks, if you want to join the conversation with Garland, Terry, and me in the Raucous Caucus, just dial in 202-889-9797, 202-889-9797. So let me start with the scandal out of Rome, because, you know, the Da Vinci Code was supposedly fiction, but if you read today's front page expose in the Washington Post, which I got to say... I was kind of surprised they had such a detailed expose. They go into the complex interrelation of all these cardinals, basically to try to make a long story short. The Vatican's finances are in trouble, and they're in trouble because they do things like paying people twice as much as the same cost outside the Vatican, which might lead to some corruption and things like that. And the bank refuses to say where things are going and so forth. So the Pope hired Archbishop Carlo Maria Vigano. And he hired Archbishop Vigano to take a look into the finances. And Vigano looked and found that the Pope's number two, Bertone, a cardinal in the Secretary of State of the Vatican, a cardinal in the Vatican, was basically running roughshod over everyone and had his own little corruption thing. We don't know all the details yet, but what we do know is that Vigano got upset and he told the Pope, and at which time Bertone got a bunch of articles written against Vigano, and it all came down to the Pope's butler, who felt that Vigano had a point, that Bertone was sort of running a little, I don't want to say mafia, but let's just say running things not quite so perfectly under the nose of the Pope. And Bertone, the butler, then turned over hundreds of documents, actually hundreds of boxes of documents from the Vatican to show this to the press. Now, this came out, I remember when it came out a few months ago, and the entire focus was on the butler. The butler, apparently, they said, you know, he was a little crazy or he couldn't be trusted. And the focus was on the butler and not focused on the fact that what was in the documents. What was in the documents was the butler was really doing a whistleblower thing. He was trying to show the Pope, who wouldn't listen, and then the media, that the whole Vatican facilities were corrupt. He was trying to help Vigano, who apparently was honest, get rid of Bertone. Then Vigano is kicked upstairs. He actually becomes the ambassador to the United States. The butler is put in jail, the Vatican jail, which I didn't even know existed for a few months. And the long and the short of it is, this is just the beginning, not the end. And it has nothing to do with sexual abuse. This has to do with financial scandals. And I don't know, the butler, at least in this Washington Post article, is increasingly coming out as a hero. So this raises lots of questions, and I'll throw it to either whoever, which one of you wants to start. But it looks like this is a cover-up, again, worthy of another book by Dan Brown.
Well, I wouldn't compare it to the Da Vinci Code at all, but I mean, two things that I think are really important here. One, you know, if anybody is surprised that there are politics within a church, then they haven't attended church very recently. You know, having served in a few positions in churches myself, it's unfortunately a worldly group, you know, and the same problems exist: pride, ego, you know, advantage, et cetera, et cetera. But I think there's something really important to understand here about Pope Benedict, and I'm going to take his side for a moment before everybody jumps on him too much. Whatever the chaos in there, Pope Benedict has probably done the single most significant thing in the Catholic Church history in a long, long century's time. And that is simply, for the first time ever, the Vatican's finances, whatever's happened in recent months or past months or years, but the Vatican's finances will be audited by a private outside organization. Well, that has never happened, and I'm sure that's part of the whole reason that this scandal developed, because apparently he's been pushing for this, and he has achieved it. For the first time ever, the Pope, the Vatican's financial things will be reviewed by an outside group.
Well, Terry,
that's
don't
revolutionary.
That is, but don't count your chickens just yet, because it's true that the Pope ordered it, and Vigano was going to do it. But Bertone seems to have put a stop to it, and the Pope is resigning. I don't know that it's going to happen. That was what Benedict ordered. And by the way, the article doesn't finger the Pope as being anything but a weak leader. It doesn't suggest that he was involved in the corruption in any way. But it appears that the number two, Bertone, may be more powerful than the number one, soon-to-be-gone Pope, and that he is going to squelch this outside financial investigation. Again, I don't know what these revelations will do for everything. Maybe the public knowledge of it will, you know, bring back the investigation that you're talking about, Terry. But I'm not so sure it's going to happen, particularly since the Pope's going to resign at the end of the month. Garland, what
do you
say?
Well, I don't think it's because he's weak. I think it's because he, frankly, took on the biggest issue that the Vatican has faced in centuries.
Well, that's true. But when you think about it, I mean, how is it that the Pope doesn't have this power? I mean, he's the Pope. I mean, he's supposed to be infallible when he speaks in a certain voice. If the Pope can't look into the Vatican's finances, then clearly no one can, right? I mean,
well, God, yeah, well,
but,
you know,
that's
what
they're counting on instead of anything.
And Terry brings about a good point. What happened to the governor of New York when he went after Wall Street?
Yeah.
They took him down. You know, history, he was the top guy in New York, wasn't he? He was the head man.
Yep.
And if you recall, how was he brought down? He went after the banks, he went after Wall Street, and how was he brought down? It was found that he wrote a check to a hooker, as I understand it.
Yeah, now we don't know that Pope Benedict's done that, so I want to be very clear
about
that.
Here's my point. Who would possibly be able to get access to who this guy wrote checks to other than himself or the bank?
That's right.
So, you're right. So how did that leak out? Okay, I say that to say this. Number one, whenever there's a lot of money around, you know, you start playing with that money, you start threatening people who are maybe getting access to that money, and you're threatening your own career. I think that it's clear here, either, you know, maybe the Pope did something inappropriate, but anyone who is controlling a large institution or any institution that has a lot of money can be implicated in doing something inappropriate on any given Tuesday.
Are you meaning, Garland, that Berlusconi is behind this whole thing? I think so. Yeah. I think you've got it.
What I'm saying is this. I'm not shocked if the Pope started allowing access to records, access to finances, and no one had done that before, then it doesn't surprise me that he would be implicated in some kind of scandal and go down.
Yeah, I mean,
I would say it would almost be predictable.
I was going to say, the Pope seems to, for at least from the Washington Post account, he's actually a good guy in this. He's just weak. I mean, it sounds like Bertone, number two, did not like the Pope looking into the finances, and that's why they kicked the guy looking into it upstairs. They kicked him to the United States. There's one more element, though, that's really, really funny about this story, which is a very long story, and I encourage everyone to read after the radio show's done, and that is that it goes into A9. The Pope, after the butler steals all these documents, which I guess is inappropriate, but I love whistleblowers wherever they are, and it doesn't seem like the butler was trying to get a big financial gain. I mean, it seems like he was really trying to expose the corruption. But anyway, after the Vatican needed some public relations repair. So what they decided to do is they decided to hire a reporter from Fox News. Gregory Burke, the Fox correspondent in Rome, is a member of Opus Dei. That's the very conservative Catholic lay organization. And the Vatican hires Gregory Burke to bring a common sense journalistic view of how things are going to play out in the church and to help craft the message. As they said in the Washington Post, Burke was more, quote, corn-fed than cannoli-fed. anyway, so then he comes in and he tells them that in his American accented Italian, that he'd love to bring Roger Ailes into this job. That Roger Ailes has a lot of power and he has very little. But what he does do is he's the guy that gets behind, hey, the Pope should tweet. And so the Pope opened, well, you may have heard a month ago, the Pope opened up his Twitter account. That's this Fox News operative. He's like, we got to bring you in the modern world. We've got to get you tweeting and we got to get you doing damage control. And this Fox News operative is really the guy behind the whole idea of blame the butler. He's a terrible, you know, demented, crazy person who just was too close to power. And so this whole sort of nastiness against the butler, rather than maybe everyone focus on the butler rather than on the fact that the documents that he provided were actually quite scandalous. And that's kind of how it went down a couple months ago. And if the Pope had not resigned, I don't think this would be a front page story in the Washington Post. I think that they would have gotten away with it. It's actually Pope Benedict's resignation that's finally drawing our attention to what really is going on behind the scenes.
I think you're absolutely right, and I think Garland hit on it too. And I mean this seriously. I mean, now you got Murdoch, and you got Berlusconi, and you know, I'm serious. You cannot underestimate Berlusconi. The man's a maniac, and you know, he's what, been president I don't know how many times simply because he owns all of the media except that part that Murdoch owns.
He's not mentioned in this article, so I don't know that.
Of course not. Of course not. He's probably not going to be, just like the bankers aren't mentioned. You know,
right?
I mean,
mention him and you disappear.
In Italy, and they have more power than the Pope could ever dream of. You know, and I have no doubt that Berlusconi is behind it, and because I have no doubt that Berlusconi had, you know, a lot of influence in the Vatican and with certain cardinals, because that's the way politics work. And these are powerful, powerful players, and they're playing for one thing: power and money.
For me,
a lot of money.
Murdoch and Berlusconi are probably tied to this. We'll never prove it, but I would guarantee it.
And there's billions. There's a lot of money here, guys. There is billions and billions of dollars. And when you get that billions of dollars floating around, these are the kind of things that happen.
For me, I found it interesting that there was a Vatican jail. So they take this butler and they like sort of lure him in and they arrest him. And I'm thinking the only guards I ever saw in the Vatican were the Swiss guards with those long spears. And I'm thinking, what do they do? Put a spear up to his throat? And then where is the Vatican jail? Is it down in the basement? And who guards it? You know, I never actually thought about it. But apparently there was a trial for the butler and it was done under the 19th century Vatican penal code, you know, 1800s penal code. And in that trial, the butler was not allowed to say all his conversations with the various cardinals and why he did what he did, which was basically to expose his corruption. They basically wouldn't let him speak about that. It only let him speak about, you know, the documents he took, but not about why.
Yeah, that's called a defense, Mark. We wouldn't want anything like that.
So, but again, all of this is coming out. So here's what I find interesting. The question for me is, where do we go from here? There's going to be a conclave. I think it's actually likely, although I don't know with Bertone in charge, but it seems to me that the Vatican has to reach out to the 42% or so of Catholics that live in Latin America, from Mexico down to Argentina and everywhere in between. That's where almost half of the world's Catholics live. Only a quarter live in Europe. And I think they've got to pick a pope from Argentina or Mexico or Latin America somewhere to give, because otherwise, if they keep picking another European, I think they're going to get a lot of angry people in their new flock. Some are even suggesting an African a cardinal in Ghana, but Africa's only 8% of the Catholics. My question for you gentlemen is, do you think they'll pick a pope from outside Europe? And if so, do you think the new pope will help clean up the mess that, this pope is leaving behind?
Not a chance. Not a chance. I mean, you know, the cardinals are very, very, very powerful. You know, there are a lot of, you know, wonderful cardinals. I have, you know, a lot of respect for some. The cardinal of New York, I forget his name, you know, I have a lot of respect for. And but it is a power game. And it's been a power game, you know, since they built the Vatican or before. And, you know, they're going to play for power. They're not about to let go of that power and bring in, you know, an African or a, you know, one from the United States or from anywhere in Latin America. It's not going
to
happen.
See, I think they'll have to do Latin America. But, Garland, what do you think?
I think that it's going to be Italian. That's my opinion. I think the Italians are, you know, upset that they haven't had, you know, they won an Italian, you know, the last guy was an Italian. In my opinion, it'll be Italian. But I'm with Terry, and here's what I think. They're not, look, after shoving the guy out the door who tried to expose him before, they certainly aren't going to bring somebody in who would, you know, tell what's going on. I think it'll be the opposite. Yeah. I think they will bring someone in that they're sure that will know how to play the game and will help them. They're going to bring someone in who help them get this thing cleaned up.
Yeah, but wouldn't that cause a crisis of faith? I mean, there's a billion or more Catholics across the globe, probably more than a billion. As I said, a huge church in Latin America, 42%. If they bring in another Italian pope who covers up everything, I know there'll be a crisis of faith among American Catholics, but I would think it would also be a crisis of faith among Latin American Catholics, who, after all, are almost half the population. This would really harm the church, wouldn't it?
Well, depends on how good, number one, depends on how good he is at cleaning it up. I think they're going to come up with a plan, and they're going to take all of this into account, and they're going to execute their plan, and you know, personally, in my opinion, I think it'll work.
And, you know, I mean, you've raised an interesting point, Mark, because it really depends on, it's an individual thing, and hopefully there's some thoughtful individuals out there. It comes down to where is your faith, you know, located? What is your faith based on? If it's based on the rulers of the institution that happens to be supposedly, you know, serving Jesus Christ or serving worship or whatever, if that's where your faith is based, you're in big trouble, you know, because you're talking about human beings. That's all you're talking about.
I just think in order to save the church, you know, and obviously I'm not Catholic, but still, it's a worldwide institution. It happens to be the largest single religion. Christianity is the largest world religion, and Catholicism is the largest single portion of that religion. And it has, you know, the Pope really is a world leader. And I think that it's a shame. I mean, look, I mean, I have my differences with the Catholic Church, to be sure, whether on abortion or gay rights or anything like that, or contraception or women's rights. But when it comes to looking out for the poor, the Catholic Church is still very strong when it comes to fighting war and fighting violence. There's still a strong voice. And I think it's a shame if they put these petty financial things ahead of what's still a very powerful message. I disagree with y'all. Maybe I'm just an optimist, but I think they're going to go with a Latin American cardinal, or maybe African, but I think Latin American, and that someone's going to have to clean house, because more articles like this one in the Washington Post are going to come out, and they're going to get uglier and uglier, and I think they've got a clean shop.
In a way, I hope you're right, because, I mean, obviously any institution needs house cleaning on a regular basis. And, you know, we could talk about every institution you and I have been associated with.
That's true.
You know, some cleaning the house. But I still think power rules, and, you know, I don't want to, you know, keep on pounding it, but I have no doubt that there is connection between Berlusconi and a lot of cardinals, and connection between Berlusconi and money. And the money in the Vatican, and that's who's going to be in charge of it, you know. Because, you know, Berlusconi's going to be president again, I mean, of Italy, I mean, or prime minister, or whatever it is.
Doesn't he have to find some 16-year-old girls first? Isn't that a requirement in order to become prime minister of Italy? I forget how many he's had.
That's just a personal hobby of his own.
Okay.
It has nothing to do with
that. I thought that was a privilege that came with the office. Folks, if you want to join in this discussion, crazy it is, it's 202-889-9797. 202-889-9797. We'll take a quick break. And then when we come back, Terry wants to talk about our disaster preparedness or lack thereof. And we'll be right back right after this. Welcome back to the Raucous Caucus. This is Mark Levine with Terry DeKester and Garland Nixon, and we're going to move on to Terry's topic. And then, Garland, if you won't pick a topic, I'm going to impose upon you the post office. So you got 20 minutes to see if you want a better topic. But, Terry, it's your turn. You wanted to talk about disaster preparedness.
Well, yeah, because it's come home to roost, and I'm in the midst of the next disaster, major disaster of the United States, and it has always fascinated me, though, that, you know, what we like to do is complain about, you know, the fact that we didn't get the power on in a day and a half, rather than do much to really prevent, not prevent disasters, of course, but to ensure whatever protection we can for disasters.
Did something happen in Oregon that I didn't hear about?
Yeah, apparently. Well, you know, the West Coast doesn't care about the East Coast.
Well, yeah, apparently. I mean, we're in Washington, and you're too far away. I mean, you're
away. You're in the center of the universe, you know.
Exactly. I mean, I'm within the Beltway, so the rest of y'all don't matter. What happened in Oregon?
I mean, you know, if nothing else, and I think this is important, you know, we live in the age of distraction. We don't live in the age of information. We live in the age of distraction. But there will be, within any time from now, this moment, to somewhere in the next 50 years, but it's inevitable, there's going to be a Cascadian subduction zone earthquake out here in the West, primarily in Oregon, a little bit in Washington, a little bit in Northern California, that is going to be the most destructive thing that has ever hit the United States of America. And this is not...
So, well, there's a few redwood trees. Well, I mean, you know, I'll miss them, but...
Well, the redwood trees, you know, will probably suffer a little bit. But just let me give you a little bit of information here. It'll be a 9.0 higher earthquake. It's exactly a mirror image of what happens in Japan.
You're causing panic among our West Coast listeners right now,
Good.
Jerry.
Good, because I'd like to see some action taken. This is a brand new report that has come out. They've been studying it for years. It involves 150 scientists and organizations, everything from the Red Cross to geologists, et cetera. Let me give you a little bit here what will actually happen. There will be no water or sewer service, no electricity, no ATMs, telephones, television, radio, internet. The bridges around here, which there's scores of, there's 11 bridges into Portland, will be impassable. Food will soon run out. It's a mirror image of Japan's. It'll have a minimum of 650 to 5,000 people killed right in the Portland area. The tsunami may wipe out as many as 15,000 people. There will be 27,000 households are likely to be displaced. The entire nation has never witnessed a disaster of this magnitude in modern history. And it just goes on and on and on how large this earthquake is going to be. And considering the population concentration, it's actually going to affect not only, you know, this area, but it'll actually have a major effect on the U.S. economy, because it's going to take years to repair the damage, if the damage can be repaired. It's absolutely
phenomenal.
Now,
what are your sources for all this scary
Pardon?
Stuff? What are your sources for all this scary
well,
stuff?
Well, the fault line and the discovery wasn't actually made until 1980, and they discovered that, oh, man, they got a big problem here.
But
the
San Andreas fault...
And they hadn't worried about that.
The San Andreas fault is south of you. That goes through San Francisco and L.A., right?
Yeah, this is part of the... It's called the Cascadian subduction zone, the... I forget which plate is going under which plate, but there are two plates that are going, you know, one's going underneath the other one and driving it under and building the tension, and has been building it. It happens every 350 to 400 years. We're way past due.
But and, I mean, what can really be done? I mean, I was in Los Angeles at the time of the Northridge quake, and actually there was relatively little damage for a powerful quake. I was in a high-rise working in a law firm. At a 55-story building, I was on the 37th floor, and the entire skyscraper was on wheels. And there's nothing weirder than being on the 37th floor of a tall skyscraper that is moving. That's a very strange thing, but it kept it from collapsing. I mean, it seems to me that we are as prepared as we can be. What more can we do?
Oh, there's hundreds and thousands of things. I mean, buildings have to be retrofit. A simple thing, you know, is the schools around here. It's about the only thing that's getting any attention. You know, the disaster within school buildings will be, if it strikes in the daytime and during the school hours, will be phenomenal. There are an amazingly simple plans to create these little structural zones in schools that would be a safety zone that would protect the students, and it doesn't cost that much. My real point out of all of this, besides the fact, you know, that why the heck am I here, you know, is that they have actually said editorially in the papers here and the politicians, well, there's nothing we can do about it, you know, which is absolutely, reprehensibly irresponsible. I mean, you can do things about it. There are structural things you can do to every building. There's, you know, just emergency response is essential. Simple things like establishing independent small radio stations as opposed to all the stations who are linked together on the major towers like most of them are in Washington, D.C. And, of course, in an earthquake, all those towers are going to go down. You're not going to have any communication. There's a million things that can be done that I've been researching, you know, since I first heard of this a couple of weeks ago. But the real point is, is everybody is just sitting on their butt saying, oh, well, what can we do about it?
Well, let me go to Garland.
This is how you get a Katrina. You know, this is exactly how you get Katrina.
But I also don't know that these things can be fixed. I mean, we had an asteroid, a meteorite, just land in Russia. The biggest thing to fall from the sky in 100 years near a relatively populated area. I don't know if y'all saw those pictures or not.
Yep.
But my thought was, yeah, what are you going to do? I mean, meteorites fall from the sky. Earthquakes happen on Earth. You can prepare like they're doing in California. I mean, they have much better building structures, I think, in California than they do in Japan. But I'm not sure what more we could do. Let me see if Garland can break the tie here. Garland, what do you think?
I think there is more. Well, okay. Yes, and I'm
Garland can't
decide. Physically, in practical application, there are lots of things we can do. I agree with Terry. There are things we can do, which would be such as strengthen NEMA, strengthen our preparedness and things like that, and our response. Because keep in mind, you can't stop these things from happening, but you can certainly work on your ability to respond to them and to recover. However, that's in the real world. The only way we can get to the real world is if the political world has the wherewithal to do it. Well, the bottom line is, I mean, right now, there is nothing that can be done. We can't even, right now, the greatest threat to the United States economy is the House of Representatives of the United States government. So we can't, no, Terry's right. We can't do anything. We're not going to do anything. We've got people who, in the House of Representatives, who during Katrina begged for money, got billions, Sandy hits New York and they vote against it and say, well, no, they shouldn't get any money. We should find other cuts before we give them any money.
Well, that's because those representatives are from Louisiana, not New Jersey.
Yeah, which goes to say, oh, for God's sake, do you realize that people out in Oregon and California vote for Democrats?
That's right. So they're not
going to get nothing.
Right.
But there's a key point, you know, that's sort of been brought up here. And the way our whole society and our whole government and our information system has changed. And this is kind of essential. There were things in place, you know, in New Orleans. Was it adequate? No. Who was the first people to admit that it was inadequate? The Army Corps of Engineers.
That's true.
There was a time when we put in, like the Army Corps of Engineers did in New Orleans, you know, dikes and levees all over the place, which proved inadequate for a hurricane the size of Katrina. But we even knew that, and the Army Corps of Engineers knew that, and we knew it was going to happen. And what I'm talking about is predictable. These are predictable disasters.
Tell me what the Army Corps of Engineers are saying now, because having lived in Los Angeles during the Northridge quake and having seen quakes absolutely destroy Haiti, in Japan, the tsunami was incredibly catastrophic. The Northridge quake was actually not that catastrophic. I mean, it wasn't good, a lot of buildings, but because of building codes in Southern California, they were largely able to keep deaths down, and it was actually a fairly manageable earthquake. There were just property damage. Do you think that Oregon is behind California in this regard, or do you think it's just that the quake is going to be bigger and badder than Northridge?
Oh, it's very much behind California. I mean, you know, California knew about their earthquake going back to San Francisco and way before.
Sure.
You know, they knew this was a problem from the beginning. And up here, a little further in the northwest, they knew that there was an earthquake problem. They didn't think it was big. Then they studied it in 1980, and they said, oh, wow, this is really a problem. So they put in a few laws, you know, on codes on how things should be constructed. The point is now they figured out, whoa, we didn't even begin to understand this. Excuse me, please. And it's going to be much more disastrous. You could do a simple thing that could be done immediately, for instance, is you simply put a moratorium on all construction. You just say, okay, now there's a moratorium. You know, you're going to build this house. That's fine. You can go ahead and build that house. You're going to add two steel beams at these key points.
So what you're saying,
you know,
you think California's laws, which are actually quite strict on building codes, are much more strict than Oregon's, and that it almost sounds to me like a state issue, that Oregon and Washington need to step up their game and join California being more earthquake prepared.
Well, it's a little heartless to say it's a state issue when thousands of people are going to be killed. But just like in New York or Katrina or anything else, it immediately becomes, when this happens, when we do nothing, then the first thing that happens is the governor of the state, if he's still alive, you know, says he wants this to be, you know, a federal disaster zone. And then the federal government's involved, and it costs you millions. And here's the most astounding fact I've uncovered.
Who's cooking in the background?
Study.
Is that you, Garland? Banging pots around?
Yeah, guys. there's a FEMA study that shows that for every $1 of prevention, you compensate for what would be $4 worth of restoration, repair, and rescue. It's a 4-to-1 advantage if you start doing preparation. And you've got to realize, too, that actually, just to give you an example, Portland is the largest grain exporting port in the United States. The food is coming out of here, the grain, and feeding the world and the United States. There's all kinds of consequences that are going to hit nationally. There's, you know, all kinds of huge corporations out here that are very, very powerful and very essential. The estimated damage is around $32 billion.
Terry, let me ask you, is there a big tsunami risk? Because what we learned from the Japanese earthquake is that the earthquake itself did relatively little damage, but the tsunami did a lot greater damage. If we've learned anything from Tropical Storm Sandy or Katrina, the storm, the winds don't do as much damage as the flooding. So in both cases, the water is more dangerous than the winds or the earthquake. Portland's inland, though, right? It's on the river there?
It's on the river, but the coast is heavily settled, and you're familiar, I'm sure, with Highway 101.
You sure?
You know, the highway, the beautiful highway that runs along the western coast of from California all the way up into Washington. And, you know, it's absolutely gorgeous. They know for a fact that there are there are 549 cave-in slides, you know, that will happen on that one highway, 549. The tsunami itself, again, will be comparable to what happened in Japan. And, you know, the tsunami in Japan didn't hit just the coast. It brings it up the rivers and goes way up the rivers into the valleys and causes extensive damage there as well.
Is there any nuclear power in the upper northwest, like
happened
in Japan?
There is, and I don't know exactly where it is or how well it is built. I haven't been able to find that out yet. But there is, yes, there are nuclear power plants in the way, too.
Garland?
Yeah, and the other thing about it is, I mean, Terry's topic overall, disaster preparedness, we do know beyond a reasonable doubt to a moral certainty that we're going to be facing Sandys and Katrinas and maybe worse, over and over and over. So this is an issue that is broader than just earthquakes. We can be sure that we're going to get the earthquake, but you know how earthquake predictions are. Earthquake predictions are somewhere between 11 and the next 212 years.
Right, that's
so
true.
It could be tomorrow, or it could be 100 years from now. It's going to get there, but you have to be prepared. On the other hand, based on what we've seen over the last 10 years, we can be sure that we're going to get some really nasty storms. Extremely destructive storms. So either way you look at it, our emergency preparedness is not where it needs to be. We're not doing anything about it. We have political gridlock, and, you know, we're just going to keep paying the price over and over and over again.
Yeah, and just think of this in terms of a jobs program. You want a jobs program? Here's a jobs program. You know, this kind of preparation would produce thousands and thousands of jobs. But, you know, why bother? Because who cares? And we're more concerned about what happened with the Pope. Not to criticize what you're talking about, Mark, but, you know, we just get distracted from things that are really essential.
Well, in terms of jobs, I think one of the biggest things that will cost a lot of jobs is the post office threatening to end mail delivery on Saturday. So, Garland, unless you've got something else to talk about, I want to talk about that in the next 20
minutes. I do have something.
Oh, you do? Sorry. All right. Well, then I'll give you a chance.
Okay, Garland, go.
What are we talking about in the next 20 minutes, then?
I'll make it brief. I won't hold 20 minutes there. But there's an issue. Okay.
Just tease it for us, and then we'll go to break, and then you'll start when we come back.
Okay. It has to do with homeschooling, sports, and Tim Tebow.
Oh, that's interesting.
I can't wait.
This sounds like an interesting topic. All right, folks, if you want to join in on any of these topics, it's easy to do. Just pick up the phone and dial WEACT Radio at 202-889-9797. 202-889-9797, whether you're listening in the Washington, D.C. area or on the web. We'd love to hear from you. Terry, Garland, and I will be right back with more of the Raucous Caucus right after this.
You're listening to WPWC WEACT Radio.
Welcome back to the Raucous Caucus. This is Mark Levine with Terry D. Kester and Garland Nixon. And Garland, it's your turn. Something about Tim Tebow and homeschooling. What are you talking about? Are you there, Garland?
We're all dancing again. We're stuck dancing.
Oh, you're stuck with more music. All right, let's turn off the music.
Wonderful music.
Holy moly.
All right, the music should be gone now, right? I believe the music is gone.
I've never done so much dancing on a radio show in my life.
I don't know that I like that mental image, but go ahead, Garland. Something about Tim Tebow and homeschooling.
Yeah, recently, Virginia, they just swatted down a bill that would allow homeschool children to play high school sports in public schools.
Right.
Tim Tebow, in fact, was a homeschooler who played in was allowed to play in public schools in Florida. The question is, that brings about a question. Should kids who are homeschoolers be allowed to play sports for public schools? There's an argument, well, their parents pay taxes, et cetera, et cetera. However, childless parents pay taxes. And here's one of the issues, the first issue that I thought up, and I'm going to throw it out to you guys. Let's say my kid is flunking out or doesn't do. Some states don't even require grades from homeschoolers. My kid's flunking out, but he's a good athlete. I homeschool him. I don't have to worry. I'm grading him. I don't have to worry about this kid flunking out. And all the other kids in school have to come to class. They have to work hard. They have to be graded under the school and grading system. And if they don't make the grades, they get cut from the team. They can't play. My kid gets my grades. I'm telling you right now, he can play. Guys, what are your thoughts? But then the question is, should they be allowed to play? Is it unfair to them? Does it take something away from the kids? What do you guys think?
I think, if I may jump in there,
sure,
that any of these efforts that create more fracture in our society, it has a racist component to it, it has a theological or a religious component to it. I'm a strong believer in public education. I am totally opposed to the way we are chopping public education up. You know, the country is divided for a million different reasons. It's going to get more divided. And the more that we create this kind of division with homeschooling, charter schools, et cetera, the less interaction we're going to have and the less community we're going to have. So nuts to them. If they want to homeschool, let them play football in their backyard.
I'm going to take another side of this. Look, I'm not a huge fan of homeschooling, but I recognize sometimes it's necessary. Maybe it helps that I have a friend who is homeschooling her child. Now, she happens to be a very highly educated person, and she has a child who, frankly, was bullied in schools. And so I understand why she's homeschooling him. It helps, I guess, for me that I happen to know these. And there's no question that homeschooling parents are everywhere from, like my friend, intelligent people who are sensitive to the needs of their kids to complete wacko religious fanatics. So there's a whole range of them. But because I don't like the fracturing of our society, I actually think it's better to have kids interact with kids, that if they're homeschooled and they can play some sports and get used to being with other kids, because it's an extremely isolating experience to homeschool a child. I think Adam Lanza, the killer at Newtown, Connecticut, I think he was homeschooled. Go good for homeschooling. But the point is that if I think it's important for whatever a kid's education is, I think it's important for kids to interact with other kids. So understanding Garland's complaint, I'm okay with giving the kid a basic test, making sure they have to pass basic reading, mathematic requirements. But if they pass the basic requirements that the other kids on the team do, if the kid's isolated enough, I'd rather not separate us enough and allow them to participate in sports.
Keep in mind, Mark, when you're throwing that out there, that's not the case. So what you're arguing for is something that doesn't exist. What you're saying is, in the best of all possible worlds, if this happened, I would be for it, right? So this, and this aren't happening.
Well, that's a compromise. So then, give the kid a test, and then if they pass the test, a basic test, not a complicated test, but a test that would let them pass, you know, and be on the team, because I do want some basic minimum standards there, and that's a way to put a standard in. I think even you might support that, Garland, right? I
mean, so are you saying then, Mark, as currently sits, based on what we're dealing with now, without those minimum standards?
Yeah, I'm against it. Yeah, I'd
say. Okay, so then overall, in the 29 states or whatever it is that don't allow it, you're with them. That if you were in the legislation, you would say, well, unless you change things and you make some more better standards, then I'm going to vote against this.
Yeah, but right? I think this is a compromise that's possible for both sides. And I would try to broker that compromise.
Now, what about the other side? Because now you're saying to parents, if your kid is not going to school, if your kid is not doing well, if your kid's got an issue, and there are parents, Mark, who are only concerned about their kid playing sports.
That's true.
And they will live with the fact that the kid's not going to class, that my kid can get in Duke because my kid's got straight A's, even though he never went to class.
Well, I think Duke.
Because I'm just going to give him all A's. Now, that may come back to haunt him in college, but your kid, who maybe didn't have the grades that mine had because I made him up myself, can't get in. I think it's unfair to the children who have to maintain standards. I think it opens the door for corruption. And I think that, you know, you're going to have to make a decision. It's a parent's decision. If you want the kids to play sports, then you got to make that sacrifice. If you don't, well, then your kid's living with your decision. And that is the case with lots of other things. In fact, there are people who their kid wants to play sports and they say no for whatever reason. They want him to work. They got a religion that doesn't allow that or something like that. So it's the parent's decision.
See, Colin,
you're also talking about two other things here. One is the insane overemphasis on sports in this country. You know, I mean, you know, whether it's universities that are, you know, spending billions on sports that they're not spending on academic development or research. You know, it's the same kind of insanity. It's also a picture. What you're going to have is you're going to have a fractured system. Here comes Joe, who wants to be a football player, who's home taught, and there's only so many people that are going to be allowed on the team, and there's only so many quarterbacks, and there's only so many halfbacks, and receivers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So some kid that's going to public school is now going to be pushed aside so that somebody who's not part of public school can step in. Why not just bring in a pro athlete and skip the middle ground entirely? And just pay the pro athlete so your school can win all the games.
Well, let me throw something else in there, Mark, that we haven't thought about. This is very important. What about private schools? There are private schools. There are some in my area that are like basketball factories. They have been for years. These private schools recruit the very best athletes from all the public schools. They bring them in there and they say, look at all these good things we can give you. Go to our school. So they recruit all of the best kids. The kids go in. You're going to have some of these basketball and football factories who have a team full of kids that they went to the parent and say, look, we want your kid to play for our school. However, your kid can't, you know, it probably won't do very well in the public schools. They sure as heck aren't going to pass in our school. You homeschool the kid. We'll help you homeschool the kid. We'll give you whatever you want. Your kid can have access to everything in our school, all the goodies, all the things that you just don't have to send them to school. So now you have some of these basketball and football factory schools who have an entire team full of homeschool children who will never ever have to worry about losing a kid to grades, and now suddenly all of the best kids and all of the best football players, the parents say, by the time my kid gets to ninth grade, boy, I'm homeschooling it, because my kid can now go to the best private school in Maryland, get straight A's, or Virginia, or whatever. And so now, if you go to private school, if you go to public school, don't even bother to try out for the team, because the spots are already taken by homeschool kids, because that's the way basketball and football factories work. Yeah, I know, because there's one near me.
Hang on. You said, Garland, that Duke is going to go, and because a parent gives his kids straight A's, that Duke is going to... Duke is more sophisticated than that. Duke knows that an A from one high school is not the same as an A from another high school, that from this public school is different than this private school. And God knows, if you're homeschooled, you're going to have to show more to a competitive college than the fact that the parent gave the kid an A. There's going to be SAT scores. There's going to be essays.
You're being naive, Mark. I know people that have gone to colleges that they had no business getting in and passed the whole time because they had two and three tutors for every class.
Well, they weren't writing their papers.
So don't think that kids cannot go to a school that they could not pass under any circumstances, pass every class, and continue to play football. Penn State was making $70 million a year off of football. Those kids weren't failing.
Yeah, Garland touched on it, Mark. Don't forget the money issue. There's a money issue in this as well. You know, because sports always tend to dominate academic situations. You know there's corruption in every sports program on a national level, in the NCAA, et cetera, et cetera.
That's true.
And I'm not just talking about abuse. You've probably read the test that the athletes are given in their classes, which are so basic that a one-year-old blind person could pass them.
Listen, I tutored football players in college. I know, I know that they're often not up to the same academic level as everybody else.
Yeah, so why do you think it would be different?
But my point is,
because what you're doing is you're not really allowing a particular child to go to school and play football. What you're doing is you're allowing that coach to get more notoriety and more power, and you're letting the school get more and more notoriety and more power. That's the only reason you're playing the game.
You know what? I think if we actually took this question and divided it into whether kids should be able to play sports with other kids and whether kids should be able to play at the kind of professional level that it's not professional, but that college football and basketball sports have become. It's a difference between saying this kid is isolated. He's 16. He's only with his parents all the time. You know, he needs to get out more and play with other kids. I'm very sympathetic to that. I am much less sympathetic, you both are right, to the big money industry that's become collegiate athletics. So it's you know, intramural stuff. I mean, I don't think either of you have any problem with that kind of stuff. You're talking about really the capacity for corruption.
Yeah, and there's also, I mean, you probably are aware too. I mean, I had some neighbors, two young men who were very good baseball players, and by the time they were 13 and 14, they were playing in money, paid money, you know, sports teams that travel around the state.
No way.
You know, there's this whole private.
Wait. People paid to see a little league game of 13 and 14 year olds?
Hey, it was one hell of a pitcher.
Oh, my God.
You better
God.
Believe it.
You've got AAU going on, which there's a lot of money floating around with AAU, not necessarily for the kids, but for people who are involved. If you're a college coach, Mark, you're a college coach. You're making $2 million a year. If you don't win, you get fired.
Okay.
As we saw in Penn State, they're not going to ask you what's happening behind the scenes. But they're not going to say, hey, all your kids. No, you win. And so if you are in an environment where you're making a lot of money, you don't want to lose that money, you'll be out of work, you do whatever you have to do within the rules. You're a lawyer. Mark, you know what happens with lawyers. They'll hire a team of lawyers and say,
exactly,
find every way I can get home, the best homeschooler, and they will go to the parents and instruct the parents what to do.
But this
when
is a problem.
Yes.
But here's the thing, God. This is a problem much larger than homeschooling. The problem of sports and money and kids getting wrapped up in it is a huge problem, and the homeschooling is a tiny, tiny part of it. I think you know, even if you banned all homeschoolers from participating in collegiate athletics, you're not even touching the problem. I just think you're talking about a much larger problem. To me, the homeschool kids are, there's a wide variety of them, from very normal kids to very unusual kids, from normal parents to very unusual parents. And I think sometimes kids have special needs. I mean,
but you know, Mark, I mean, the whole foundation supposedly of this country, you know, is all men are created equal. You know, that's the foundation there. Now, yes,
right.
It's a myth. Yes, it's ideal. It's an ideal fantasy almost. But the point is, we sort of strive for creating somewhat of an equal playing field. We sort of tried to keep things somewhat equal. We certainly did that with public education during its heyday, whatever its flaws may or may not have been. Now we're just talking about another way of fracturing that system and saying, oh, wow, this guy weighs 433 pounds, and he's home taught. I want him on my team. I don't care if he buries all the guys who weigh 100 pounds.
Yeah, I know a kid near me. There was a kid who is in the NFL right now. He was in high school. He was 6'7" and weighed 325 pounds, All-American football player. He had trouble with grades. He was a good kid, had trouble with his grades. After he got out of high school, he had to go to this kind of a prep school for a year to get his grades up, and he went to Virginia. Good kid. Went to Virginia, started, and he's playing, last I checked, for Kansas City. He's an offensive lineman. Now, in the event that homeschooling was available, this kid had to go to a prep school and work hard, which was actually in his best interest. In the event that he could homeschool, this guy in 10th grade, all of a sudden he's homeschooling for 3 years and he goes to wherever, but he's not as academically prepared. He doesn't have to work. You create a very bad environment. And when you say money in sports is a problem, I disagree. It's not a problem. It's a reality. Money in the banking industry is a problem. No, it's a reality. Money in every industry. Money in, might I say it, the Vatican.
There you go.
They're always going to create these inconsistencies between our values and the law. So we have to accept that the idea that, oh, money in sports is bad. Look, if people don't want the sport, they stop paying $150 a ticket. I'm not going to stop watching the Skins or the Wizards or the Nationals. So I don't expect anybody else to.
Well, let me back off the question of sports for a second, because I think both of you seem to oppose homeschooling. I mean, we used to have truancy laws, and if you didn't send your kid to school, they were a juvenile delinquent, that they could be picked up and forced against their will to go to school, and there weren't provisions for homeschooling. It sounds like Garland, at least you, maybe you too, Terry, you oppose homeschooling, period. You would ban it.
Let me give you a quick example.
Let me make this very brief. I'll make this real quick, Terry. What I think is that there should be a board or something, and in order for homeschooling, for you to justify it, you should have to go to this board, such as your friend with the kid being teased, and you should have to go through stringent guidelines, and it should be the rare exception. I don't think every schmuck who wants to homeschool his kids because they're people of the wrong color or whatever the case may be in the school in that area, that everybody should be able to do it. And I think the parents should be able to demonstrate some proficiency themselves. You've got people who are absolutely ignorant teaching a kid who can barely read and write themselves.
That's true.
I mean, I had the privilege of tutoring a couple of kids in my neighborhood in Virginia that were homeschooled.
Perfect example. Those kids learned absolutely nothing. I couldn't resist that, Terry. You just set that one up.
Yeah. No, they were wonderful kids, and they were both, again, you know, superb athletes. And they really were wonderful kids, and the parents kept them home only because the mother was a little bullied when she felt she was bullied when she was high school, so she was scared for her children. That was the primary motivation. The protect them from what might happen.
Uh-huh.
Well, these kids are great. They really honestly are great. I really have a lot of respect and love for them. They have the social skills of a rock.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's what I'm afraid of. That's why I actually have some sympathy for mainstreaming kids that are homeschooled, because whatever choices their parents make, it's not fair to the kids. They could have great teaching, but they need to have social skills. They need to interact with other kids. That's why I'm real leery of making some rock hard prohibition against, particularly if it's not money, it's not collegiate athletics, it's just a matter of them playing with the local soccer team, you know, or playing in intramural sports. Social skills are vital in life. It's
intramural,
not just
sports,
academics.
Yes.
Right. So I think
intramural sports, yes.
All right. So that's the part that I'm sympathetic to. I'm not sympathetic to the Tim Tebows and collegiate athletics of the world.
Yeah. I mean, it's a divisive thing. It really honestly is. And it was tragic watching these two boys grow up, you know, because they started out in public schools. They were doing okay. They went to Catholic schools for a while. They were doing okay. Then they got home taught, and they were home taught primarily by their grandmother, who was a sweet, wonderful lady and didn't know squat.
Mm. Well, I agree with Garland that there should be some standards for homeschooling. I'd have no problem with that. Show that the kids can pass certain tests and that the parents have some knowledge of what they're talking about. And there should be special situations, like a kid that's in trouble or has special needs, maybe an autistic kid or a kid that had a bad school experience, not the kid's fault. We can go on, but I'm afraid our time is up for the Rockies.
Oh, I think the three of us should go out and start playing some professional sport. I think we could.
You wouldn't want to see me do that. Your team would not win. Okay, you might want to see it, but the team would not win, so we don't want that.
At my age, I think I'd tear an ACL just watching a sport, walking over to the refrigerator to get a beer.
Yeah, well, I'm not talking about survival anymore, guys. I've given up on that.
Well, Terry, you can roll in your wheelchair. We'll have wheelchair basketball. But that's all the time we have for the Rockets Caucus. Tune in every Sunday at noon for more of the Rockets Caucus right here on We Act Radio, AM 1480, or on my website at marklevinetalk.com. Thank you, Garland. Thank you, Terry. Coming up next is the Inside Scoop. I want to focus on the Vatican scandal. I want to talk about the post office, since Garland and Terry didn't. And also want to move on and talk about Chris Dorner and what happened in that weird, bloody shootout and fire out there in Big Bear, California. So stay tuned for the Inside Scoop. This is Mark Levine. I'll be right back right after this.